Support for 51% comes from Berkshire Co-op Market, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, a community-owned natural grocery store dedicated to sustainable agriculture, the local economy, and the environment, working within the community to better Berkshire County one basket at a time. Berkshire.coop.
On this week's 51%, we hear from a multidisciplinary artist known for her feminist performance art.
What I say now is that my use of the body has obscured my body of work.
And hear what is being done to help the growing number of homeless female veterans. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Carolee Schneemann talks about painting, performance, censorship, and resistance in a telephone conversation recorded just days before she received the Golden Lion for Lifetime Achievement at the 57th Venice Art Biennale. Kathy Bird from Fresh Art International brings us the piece.
Indulgence.
The persistence.
The personal.
Painterly mess. The dense.
Feelings.
Clutter. The persistence.
The
gestalt.
Of feelings.
The primitive.
Touch.
Techniques. I
sensibility.
Don't take the
touch,
advice
the diaristic
of men who only talk to themselves.
This is Fresh Art International. I'm Kathy Bird. You just heard an excerpt of a 1995 variation of Interior Scroll, the iconic 1975 work performed by American artist Carolee Schneemann. In a vast underground cave, Schneemann and seven nude women performed the ritualized actions of the original performance, reading the texts aloud as each slowly extracts the scroll from her vagina. Today, I'm thrilled to share the telephone conversation I recorded with the artist just days before she receives the Golden Lion for Lifetime Achievement at the opening ceremony of the 57th Venice Art Biennale in Venice, Italy. Carolee Schneemann started as a painter in the 1950s. In the 1960s, she began using her own body as material in experiments with film, music, poetry, dance, and performance. Since then, she's explored a range of cultural and political taboos. Her groundbreaking work continues to move us.
You've transformed art and my knowledge of it as it relates to the body, sexuality, and gender like no one else has. Everyone remembers the provocative performances.
Performance is a dilemma for me. I'm fighting that constantly now. I'm a visual artist. I'm a painter. Everything I do comes out of the discipline of perception, of paying attention to the elements around me. And all my disciplines come from painting. The rhythm, the structure, duration, fragmentation, integration. Painting led me to activate the body and to introduce actions that I felt were struggling against the wall of male fetishization and male conventions surrounding the female body and its perception. But for the past 25 years, I have not done performance. I do installations. I'm working with very complex computer systems and motorized elements, and I've been working with motorized installations since 1965. It's very hard for me to have to be locked into the most seemingly audacious works, because what I say now is that my use of the body has obscured my body of work. Interior Scroll was a dream image. I never thought it would be enacted or that it could possibly be shocking. It was a very simple little residual waking image that I made a drawing of a woman with her leg up extracting a message from her vagina that was a cautionary set of perceptions about film and gender. So when I enacted that work, I always thought it was very simple, and I had no idea it would have such a sustaining presence and an ideology and also create great trouble for me. I would lose jobs because of it. I would lose exhibits because part of the group, the organization that would advise museums on their investments would be composed of very angry men who felt all my works pornographic. So it's been a very complex, long haul through these simple visualizations.
It was my privilege to include your work in Potentially Harmful, The Art of American Censorship, the exhibition I curated for Georgia State University in 2006. We featured Cycladic imprints, photographs from that multimedia installation from 1989. You experienced censorship on so many levels. You still have this enduring legacy. Everything you do has been provocative because you've built this way of working with your own body and about the body through different media that have established a new art history for women, I think.
Oh, thank you, Kathy. That's generous. You know, I have a veil over all the appreciation. I think it's wonderful, but I'm never sure it's really real anymore because for so many years the work was denigrated. And the most suppressed work of all is the work that I do examining violence, examining destruction, the systematic mayhem that defines our culture, but it's always occluded because we have, as Americans, all our aggressions are righteous and principled. The Vietnam work in 65 that consumed me and was always in juxtaposition to my work of the ecstatic and the domestic ordinary. I'm always moving between those two realms. The work I did on 9/11, Terminal Velocity, just wanting to make in memoriam to the images of the falling bodies, to be as close to them as I visually could, and to feel that they were sacrosanct. When those images, those permutated photographs, were first exhibited, many people were outraged that I would dare depict and bring forward the vulnerability of our culture, that people could be shown as they were dying. It incited revengeful anger. The real premise is that I believe in looking at the difficult things that my culture wants to suppress and not examine.
What do you hope will be viewed as the most significant contribution that you've made in the field?
I think the example of the equitable heterosexual couple, which was a very early definition sustaining my work in my life. My life with James Tenney, the composer, in documented or transformed as an unerotic film in Profuses. And that's 1965, and that's very early, and that's still basic to what has sustained my sense of purpose and potentiality. Also that I've been in the same house since 1965, and it's a magic, very blessed place. And my hope would be to somehow find a way to sustain this space so that it could be available to other writers or thinkers, artists, not for building and making, because it's a house from 1750, and we want to keep it and not cover it in paint and heavy materials, but it's got such a embracing, positive atmosphere that people always come to their best images and feelings of potential work here.
What would be your advice to artists who would like to, I guess, resist the classical or traditional definitions of women, relationships, resistance, feminism? What would you suggest to them as the most important thing to remember as they create their work?
Research. I think research to understand what underlies the contemporary contradictions. Get all the knowledge you possibly can that makes sense to your purpose and to work together to form a community of focus and to be as fearless as possible.
The logic of
and
which are inflicted upon
systems.
My work
viewers.
Has
it's
no
true,
meaning
I said,
beyond.
When I watch,
I have done away.
It's true, I said, when I watch your films, my mind wanders freely. During the half hour of pulsing dots, I compose letters, dream of my lover, write a grocery list, rummage in a trunk for a missing sweater, plan drainage pipes for the root cellar. It is pleasant not to be manipulated.
This is Fresh Art International. I'm Kathy Bird. You've been listening to my conversation with American artist Carolee Schneemann. A pioneer feminist artist with an unflinching gaze, she addresses subjects that many would suppress. This year, after a lifetime of fearlessly challenging normative cultural values, she's in the global spotlight. She receives the Golden Lion at the 57th Venice Art Biennale, in an upcoming solo exhibition at the Hales Gallery in London. Her interactive installation of suspended monitors in More Wrong Things explores decades of public and private tragedies and suffering in the U.S., Asia, and the Middle East. Museums of Modern Art in Frankfurt, Germany, and New York will present kinetic painting, originating at the Museum of Modern Art in Salzburg, Austria. This retrospective exhibition spans six decades of her seminal work. Carolee Schneemann encourages us to trust our passionate sense of the work we must do despite any opposing forces.
For more information, you can go to freshartinternational.com. Women are the fastest growing demographic of homeless veterans, but they tend to be undercounted and underserved. Only a few housing programs for former service members specialize in helping female veterans. Rebecca Shear introduces us to one of them in Western Massachusetts.
The federal government estimates that on any given night, 3,000 to 4,000 female veterans are homeless. But that estimate's probably on the low side, says Sarah Skoko, who directs the women's program of the nonprofit group Soldier On.
When people are doing homeless counts, they're going to shelters. They're seeing people on the street. A female veteran is not the person you see on the street holding a sign.
She might be a single mom. She may have experienced sexual trauma. So, says Skoko, these women are holing up in their cars, they're couch surfing. As a result,
the issue of female veteran homelessness is so underlooked, understudied. It's not understood because it's not in your face all the time.
So Soldier On decided to do its part by building a transitional housing facility just for women.
So welcome to the women's program.
In this bright and airy three-story building on the VA campus in Leeds, Massachusetts, the program houses 16 women and caters to their special needs with things like art and yoga classes, support groups, and job counseling.
A lot of women that come to us have really lost everything. They've lost all sense of hope. And so all of what we do is build them back up.
Skoko says all the residents suffered some sort of trauma before, during, or after they served. 61-year-old Luann Hazelwood, who was in the Army in the 1970s and 80s, says her verbal, physical, and sexual trauma started early in life.
I more or less wanted to join the military as a way of escape.
But she experienced more trauma in the military after she got out, too. When she came to the women's program, she was fleeing her second abusive marriage and was so traumatized she didn't speak. Being only around women made her feel safer.
I can't say I've ever really had a positive relationship with a man. And, you know, I have yet to totally trust being around a man. So for me, it was a way of recouping from all the abuse that I went through.
33-year-old Paige is another resident of the program. The former Air Force technician asked that we not use her last name. She'd struggled with depression and self-esteem issues long before she enlisted. She thought being in the military might help.
I was thinking I was going to get some sort of approval and pat on the back.
Instead, Paige got verbally harassed.
You know, you're called a whore, fat bitch.
And she fell into a culture of drinking.
You party a lot. That's what happens? You work hard, you play hard.
And Paige played especially hard.
I remember going through Walmart after work one day. This is when I was drinking, and I wanted to crawl under a rock and, like, die. Because a lady stopped with her daughter and pointed to me and said, "See, honey, that's a hero. Like, I'm supposed to be here protecting you. If I can't even help myself, what the hell am I doing?"
Paige confided in a therapist. She says he threatened to have her thrown out. In the end, she was allowed to resign with an honorable discharge. After rotating through several co-ed detox programs for veterans, she found the women's program. Were you still drinking at that point?
Mm-hmm. I stopped, I think, like, the day or day before that I came in here. And I haven't had a drink since.
By 2020, the number of female veterans is expected to reach 2.2 million. So there's an intense need for more gender-specific services, says Director Sarah Skoko.
There are women that have served the hell out of our country, and they're not being recognized, and they need to be. They need to be treated, not the same way as males, but they need to be treated, period.
But demand for women-only services vastly exceeds supply. For these 16 rooms in Massachusetts, the women's program often has a waiting list and has received referrals and applications from as far away as Hawaii. I'm Rebecca Shear in Leeds, Massachusetts.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. We now bring you Dr. Sharon Ufberg with her 51% segment, Force of Nature. She interviews Marsha Jaffe, who, after a vacation to Bali in 2003, created the Quest for Global Healing conferences. The conferences wove together Balinese culture with Western dialogue and attracted participants from all over the world. Her concept emerged into the creation of the Bali Institute for Global Renewal, offering university and high school students and adult learners experiential and service learning opportunities focused on collaborative learning, learning that combines Balinese culture and wisdom with dialogue and cross-cultural exchange. Ufberg, who participated in the institute, asked what it was about Bali that ended up being the impetus for Jaffe's work.
I think the biggest thing that impacted me way back in 2003 and continues to delight me every time I come to Bali is that you get a chance to see people who are really living into their values. And they do this by ceremonies, by offerings, by continuing to live together and meet together to make decisions in everything being collaborative. So that is was a real learning point for me to say that there really are places in the world that walk their talk. And I think we as Westerners have quite a ways to go before we could really own that. We're still moving towards that. But in Bali, as one example, you can see a culture that really does have a way to connect collectively around really wonderful human values.
It really is a different orientation altogether. I mean, I know that you travel as a woman on your own all over the world, but also many, many times back and forth to Bali.
You know, when you go into countries or islands like Bali and Indonesia and other places in the world that are uniquely different than the West, you get an opportunity to establish new relationships and connections. And I think that's really unique for women. I think more than men, women have a way of making deeper connections and they can experience something that they wouldn't otherwise get a chance to do.
Yeah, I think that, you know, so many people are afraid to kind of venture off the beaten path. Certainly the work that you do brings people really away from that and more into a more natural setting of, you know, the way people live and work. And I think it's a real different kind of traveling, you know, where you
right.
meld into a community, you meet truly the people, and you're not just interacting, like, for instance, like at a hotel. Can you share a story or two about some of the things that people might experience traveling with you or the Global Institute?
Sure. Well, I mean, and what we've done is basically looked at all these amazing relationships that I started with by being there many, many times and creating these global conferences, which also meant global networks, and then looking at ways to build on those relationships since the Bali is 85% a tourism culture, and they love having people connected to them. so that our way of designing programs and experiences is to allow people to sort of come more deeply into the culture through getting to know people from rice farmers and women activists, Balinese women activists, to cultural leaders, museum owners, social activists, the royal family, and it goes on and on. It's all these interesting relationships of really being able to sit and be in dialogue with people who think quite differently and yet have and share the same human values that we have, make this experience so rich and so deep.
It really is life-changing. I know that personally.
Yes.
So, Marcia, I know this is a big year for you, that 70 is a number that's coming up on your calendar, and I think it's a very powerful, wonderful time for you personally, and I wonder if you, as a woman turning 70, have some, kind of a big agenda or life plan for your next chapter in your life, and I think it would be so much fun to hear about that if you do.
Sure. Well, I've actually already turned that corner in January.
Congratulations.
So thank you. It's a big one. It's definitely a big one. But I would say that at this stage, of course, there's so many things left to experience and do, and I'm actually lining up some interesting trips on my own, heading out to Laos and Vietnam, and hope to get to Africa and other places that I haven't been before. But I'm aware now of the fact that I'm going to become an ancestor to my great-grandchildren. And I have a sense of what I'm leaving behind. And if I could pass on something, what would it look like? And I don't have the answer to that, but it's a big question that I'm excited to start living into, that it would have been wonderful if I had known more of what my grandmother and my great-grandmother had been thinking about when they reached 70. And so now, because we can leave more things, we can write in journals, we can, do something with our computer, and certainly in 50 years there'll be all kinds of new technology that won't, that what we have right now won't even be relevant. But I think the whole idea of being connected as the ancestor to your own lineage makes you look at your, the last 30 years of your life real differently. And I'm excited about that.
I think it's interesting as women, as we age and life unfolds, that we do feel some desire, obligation, interest in sharing that wisdom and passing it down, whether it's actually from or to our own actual relatives, or it's just like-minded women, or it's, mm-hmm. Family and friends of people that we love and care about, but that this notion of, like you talk about, maybe wanting to write it down somewhere in a journal, in a book, or have a dialogue with, people that are coming up after you and sharing the wisdom of what you learned through the years. That kind of sounds like where this is leading you.
Exactly. So, I'm hoping to write a book about what I've been learning, being on this more worldly process in the last 15 years of doing Bali Institute, and where it's taking me now, where I might be in another 10 years that's going to look different than what it looks like right now. It's just so rich with, I think, little nuggets of knowledge and learning pieces that are yet to show up. And I'm just wanting to stay more conscious of when they show up, how I can sort of capture it and hold on to it, not just for me, but for the next generation. So,
well,
it's an interesting time.
Yeah, I'm certainly one who is, will be anxiously awaiting to watch and witness what your next chapter looks like. And it's so wonderful to have you here with us today. Thank you so much for being here. And this is Dr. Sharon Ufberg for Force of Nature on 51%.
That was Marcia Jaffe, founder of the Bali Institute for Global Renewal, speaking with Dr. Sharon Ufberg. Ufberg is co-founder of the personal development wellness company Borrowed Wisdom in California. She writes for The Huffington Post and Thrive Global. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1454.